Today is Monday, October 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, doctors treating President Trump for COVID-19 say he's improving, but not out of the woods yet.
The fact of the matter is that he's doing really well.
European nations look to reverse course on restrictions as COVID cases rise. Also ahead, climate change creating a record number of wildfires in California. It's all on today's International Edition. Top Democrats are voicing concern about contradictory messages coming from President Trump's doctors in the White House regarding his health. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer say doctors treating the president for the coronavirus must provide trustworthy information, and the White House and Trump need to be transparent about his condition.
No cover-up, no spinning, no half-truths, the whole story. And we're calling on the president to start being truthful, fully and wholly truthful, about his condition.
Governor Andrew Cuomo says the confusion only increases the anxiety.
I don't know why it would be purposeful, but even if it was just a mistake, it hasn't been helpful.
Democrats are also raising concerns about the contact tracing that should be going on and about the president's Rose Garden event leading up to his coronavirus, which they call a super spreader. Julie Walker, New York.
Trump's doctors revealed Sunday that they gave the president a steroid treatment typically only recommended for the very sick. Speaking to reporters outside the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center Sunday, White House physician Dr. Sean Conley says Trump's vitals look good and he could be discharged as early as today. He also noted that previous comments were not meant to mislead.
I didn't want to give any information that might steer the course of illness in another direction. And in doing so, it came off that we were trying to hide something, which wasn't necessarily true.
Besides the steroid, the president is being treated with an antiviral and an experimental antibody cocktail. Joining us to have a better sense of what these treatments indicate is Dr. Rajesh Gandhi. He's an infectious diseases physician at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. He's also on the National Institutes of Health COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel and works with the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Thank you so much for being with us. Tell us about these medicines, what they do, and if they can potentially help keep symptoms from getting worse.
So I think the way to think about COVID-19 is on a spectrum. So most people with COVID-19 have very mild disease, and those people who have very mild disease don't need any treatment, and they'll recover on their own in most instances. But COVID-19, especially in older people, especially in people who have other illnesses or other comorbidities, can get worse and become more and more severe. And some of these treatments that we're hearing about in the news are really targeted to preventing that. So let's start with the first treatment we heard about, which is a cocktail of antibodies from a company called Regeneron. This is an experimental therapy. It's being studied in people with mild to moderate disease, that is people who are not yet in the hospital. And there are some early preliminary results that are promising, that cocktail of antibodies can reduce the amount of the virus levels. And there's also some data, it's all preliminary, that these experimental drugs can improve symptoms. But a lot of the focus on those antibodies is early in the course of the disease before people end up in the hospital. They're also studying it in people who are in the hospital, but the preliminary word is data on people who are not yet in the hospital, people with mild or moderate disease. Now, what distinguishes mild and moderate disease from severe disease? It really depends on how much oxygen you're on. Mild and moderate disease, people are not on oxygen. But when people have enough infection in the lung that they need oxygen, that's usually considered more severe disease. And so some of the drugs we've been hearing about are really targeted for people in the hospital when they have more severe disease. Let's start with remdesivir. Remdesivir is an antiviral, and it has been shown to speed up recovery in people in the hospital, particularly those people who are on oxygen. So that's why I believe the president received remdesivir, is because the doctors who were treating him wanted to hopefully prevent further worsening and to hasten his recovery. Now, what we've learned most recently is he's on a drug called dexamethasone. That's not an antiviral. That's actually a steroid, and steroids are used to decrease inflammation. We know that when the disease gets worse. People with COVID-19 can have excess or a hyper-exuberant immune response, and the purpose of the dexamethasone is to tamp down that immune response. There are good data for dexamethasone in people who are on oxygen that it actually improves survival, and so I believe that the president received dexamethasone because we were told that he did require oxygen, and so I'm sure his doctors felt that he needed that extra boost, that reduction of the inflammation that he would get from dexamethasone. It tells me, though, that his disease is severe enough that they feel like his oxygen is low, he needs extra oxygen, and that's why I believe they would use dexamethasone.
So you don't think that all of these drugs are simply being given just as precautionary measures? You think that on some level there's concern?
We were told that for at least a period of time, his oxygen levels were below 94%, and that's usually considered a level at which a person should get supplemental oxygen, and I do believe that's why he was put on supplemental oxygen. And that's in a very large trial done in the United Kingdom that benefited from these drugs like dexamethasone. So I do think since he needed oxygen, his disease must be severe enough that they feel like they needed that drug to be added. Like I said, most people have milder disease and never need oxygen, but maybe about 15% of people will get to the point that they will need oxygen, and that's when you deploy these drugs.
Given his age and some other potential health issues the president may be challenged with regarding battling COVID-19, would you say that he's still at a risk of getting worse even with all of these treatments?
That's a good question. In addition to the spectrum of severity, there's also different timelines in which these symptoms can develop. People usually who are exposed to COVID-19 when they get it, usually on average takes about 4 to 5 days before they get symptoms. Sometimes it can take up to 2 weeks after you acquire COVID-19 to get symptoms. About a week after you first start developing symptoms is when some people can develop shortness of breath, and that's when some people can get quite ill. Now, not everyone gets quite ill. As I mentioned, most people don't have any complications, but I think the reason why he's needing to be monitored carefully is because we believe, from what I've read at least, that his symptoms started sometime last week. And so for this next week, things to be watching out for are shortness of breath and low oxygen. And so that kind of careful monitoring is needed. As to whether these medicines that he's received will prevent that from happening, hopefully they will. I mean, that's their goal. But I think he's going to definitely need post-monitoring over the next week or so to make sure that he stabilizes and that he essentially gets better.
Dr. Rajesh Gandhi, infectious diseases physician at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. He is on the National Institutes of Health COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel and the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Thank you for being with us. Joe Biden's campaign says the Democratic presidential nominee tested negative for coronavirus Sunday. The results come 5 days after Biden spent more than 90 minutes on the debate stage with President Trump. Biden had 2 negative tests on Friday as well. With the number of coronavirus cases rising, France has now reversed course on some of its loosening of restrictions, just as people were starting to get back to some sense of normalcy. Joining us from Paris is reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, what's the latest?
The French government declared Paris a maximum alert area late on Sunday because of increasing COVID-19 infections and the increase in hospitalizations. Among the new measures, bars will have to close for at least 2 weeks, and employers are being asked to allow as many workers as possible to work from home or to take holidays. Further details of these restrictions will be announced Monday and will come into effect Tuesday and will last for at least 2 weeks. It follows a surge in cases, not just here in Paris, but across the country, across France. More than 29,500 new cases were reported over the weekend alone.
It really seemed like many nations that were really hard hit in Europe by the pandemic early on were on the right track.
It did seem that way. Over the summer holiday period, numbers went right down across Europe. But now we're seeing dangerous increases and governments are having to step in to reimpose restrictions. In the Spanish capital, Madrid, there's been a partial lockdown imposed and residents of the capital and 9 towns nearby can't leave the city except for work, school or medical reasons. And that follows a soaring COVID infection rate of 730 cases per 100,000, by far the highest in the European Union. Meanwhile, in Italy, after rising cases locally, authorities in Rome have made wearing of face masks mandatory when in public, and that's in the capital and the surrounding region. It follows similar rules in place in four other Italian regions.
And are EU nation leaders looking at the likelihood of a continuing rise in cases, and how are they planning on balancing another surge with plans they've already put into place for economic recovery from the first wave?
Certainly. Speaking to medical authorities here in France, there doesn't seem to be any prospect of a let-up on the horizon. Predictions are that the number of infections, particularly in large metropolitan areas, could increase substantially as the colder weather sets in. Of course, the winter flu season is also just around the corner. So it's a balancing act, though, keeping the economy moving while enforcing the social distancing, asking more people to work from home, restricting people's movements and social gatherings. Officials here in France, at least, say if managed correctly, it can work, but only if the population follows clear guidelines.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thanks so much. New European Union sanctions against Belarus came into effect on Friday, even as the bloc warned Turkey could face the same fate over a maritime dispute during a two-day summit in Brussels last week. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris on some of the summit's highlights.
The EU sanctions target some 40 Belarusian officials, but not President Alexander Lukashenko, over flawed August elections and a tough crackdown on subsequent protests. European Union leaders announced the measures following hours of talks in the Belgian capital after managing to overcome opposition from tiny member Cyprus. Nicosia had been holding out in hopes of a similar move against Turkey over disputed oil and gas rights in the eastern Mediterranean. Instead, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen urged Ankara to pursue dialogue with both Greece and Cyprus in settling what the EU considers a legal infringement in Cypriot waters. In a statement, the bloc warned of consequences otherwise.
In case of such renewed actions by Ankara, the EU will use all its instruments and options available. We have a toolbox that we can apply immediately. But this is not what we want. We want and would prefer to work on a new, long-term EU-Turkey relationship.
A senior Turkish official told news agencies Friday that EU sanctions would make Turkey even more determined to pursue what he described as its territorial rights in the Mediterranean. On Thursday, though, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said he wanted to resolve differences peacefully. EU leaders also called in a statement for an immediate end to fighting between Armenian and Azerbaijani forces over the breakaway region of Nagorno-Karabakh and warned against foreign interference.
300 combattants ont quitté la Syrie pour rejoindre Bakou en passant par Gaza.
French President Emmanuel Macron accused Turkey of sending jihadists from Syria to join the conflict, which he said was unacceptable. Ankara has denied sending mercenaries. The two-day EU summit addressed a raft of other thorny issues, including its relations with China and whether to tie billions of dollars of coronavirus recovery funds to adherence by member states to the rule of law. A first-ever assessment by the European Commission, the bloc's executive arm, found Hungary and Poland in particular faced democratic challenges. Several countries also faced high-level corruption and free press issues, according to the assessment. Separately, the Commission also took legal action against Britain over its decision to override parts of a Brexit agreement. The Commission president is set to hold talks Saturday with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
As the November 3rd presidential elections in the U.S. approach, many voters in states that allow it are already taking advantage of casting their ballots early, either in person or by mail. In Virginia, residents got a chance to vote early starting on September 18th, and indications are turnout is beating records. Ligia Bakalets has the story narrated by Anna Rice.
A polling station in Northern Virginia, outside Washington, D.C. People start arriving early in the morning, even though the elections are more than a month away. The line only gets longer as the day progresses. Everybody is wearing masks and practicing social distancing. The average wait time is about 45 minutes.
It seems to be at least an hour, more than an hour perhaps.
And you are ready to stay?
Of course. American democracy is on the line.
I didn't expect it, but it's been moving much faster than I thought it would. Yeah, I have to work today, but this is more important right now, so I'm going to do it.
The turnout so far for the November 3rd elections is at a record high. Fairfax County election head Gary Scott says he hasn't seen lines this long in his 24-year career.
The comparison is we had a grand total of 137,000 absentee voters in person and by mail. And this year we've already sent out more absentee ballots than that. As I said, we've sent 170,000 out. So we're looking that probably two-thirds of our voters will have either cast or received a ballot prior to Election Day.
Experts say, on average, about half of U.S. voters will cast their ballots early.
I'm projecting about 150 million people will vote, and about half of those people will vote prior to the Election Day. So we're looking at about 75 million people that could vote before Election Day.
While there is intense interest in the presidential race, the main reason for this wave of early voting, experts say, is the coronavirus pandemic. People are simply afraid of crowds during Election Day.
I'm just kind of worried about what might happen and making sure that, you know, my normal voting place is going to be open and available. And as I said, I'm very passionate about making some change this year, and been very frustrating, obviously, in 2020.
Because of the pandemic, many states have simplified the procedure of early voting and mail-in ballots. This year, anyone can vote by mail.
Well, when I first started, it was very difficult to vote absentee. The number of reasons you could use as an excuse was very restricted. Well, you were a student, you were in the military, you were traveling.
There is no way to change your decision once you have voted, even if you cast the ballot weeks before the election day. But that has not deterred thousands of people.
We're living in highly polarized times in the United States, and many people have already made up their mind. I dare say that some people could have cast their vote a year ago for Donald Trump, and they would not be regret that vote today if they had cast it a year ago. So people have made up their minds a long time ago.
There are, of course, plenty of Americans who will make their decision on November 3rd, and they will be the main target audience for projections of results in the presidential race. Yet, neither party will know the results of early voting until Election Day.
Early voting results are not tabulated. No one, even the election officials, will know before Election Day how many of those early votes were cast for Democrats or Republicans. The vote is, you might say, in the machine, but they haven't hit the button that says count these votes yet.
Every state has the right to decide when to start early voting. Most states will open the polls about a week before Election Day, and it is expected that local election officials will still be counting mail-in ballots days after the November 3rd vote. Олеся Бакалець in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
In a year that has already brought apocalyptic skies and smothering smoke to the West Coast, California set a grim new record Sunday when officials announced that wildfires of 2020 have scorched a record 4 million acres in a fire season that's far from over. Cal Fire said in a statement Sunday that there have been more than 8,200 wildfires since the start of the year. The fires of 2020 have killed 31 people, incinerated hundreds of homes, and forced thousands of people to evacuate. As wildfires continue to worsen under the influence of climate change, one project offers hope on how to begin to confront a problem of enormous proportions. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
In 2014, California's King Fire blackened 400 square kilometers of forest. Massive erosion followed. One of Placer County's two reservoirs filled with sediment and had to be dredged, says County Water Chief Andy Fecko.
Every time we do that, it's a $5 to $7 million cost that you incur, and you're out of business during the whole time when you're trying to clear those facilities out. And so we incurred those costs several years in a row.
And he worried about the county's other reservoir, French Meadows, just a few kilometers away.
So it was one of these watersheds that was very much under threat of a high-intensity wildfire.
These devastating wildfires are on the rise in the West, experts say, as climate change dries out the forests. And a century of misguided management has left them overgrown and extra flammable. Across the West, the unintended consequences threaten reservoirs and their drinking water and hydropower, says Angel Hertzlet of the Nature Conservancy.
There's a growing understanding from water utilities in particular that their water quality, their water quantity is very much impacted by what's happening in the headwaters.
Thinning out the forest lowers the fire risk. The forest around the French Meadows Reservoir belongs to the U.S. Forest Service. But the agency has millions of hectares across the West that need thinning, says District Ranger Michael Woodbridge.
We're always doing as much as we can with the capacity we have, but French Meadows is kind of above and beyond what that capacity would have been.
So an unusual partnership formed. The Water Agency, the Nature Conservancy, state and local governments, and others all pitched in to do the planning, raise the money, and get the work done.
And we said, fantastic, if you guys can do that with us, then we can get this work done in this area.
The partners say they're going faster and doing more than any group could have done on its own. But it will still take years. With millions of hectares across the West at risk of fire and climate change turning up the heat, Water Agency Manager FECO says Placer County's reservoirs are a cautionary tale.
I want them to learn from our experience and start taking really aggressive steps in managing their own watersheds so they don't end up in the same boat that we're in currently.
Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Leaders of Sudan's traditional government and a number of rebel groups signed a peace agreement in the South Sudanese capital of Juba Saturday, which observers hope will end nearly two decades of conflict in war-torn regions of the country, including Darfur. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Sudan's interim president, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, captured the joyful mood surrounding the peace accord Saturday, chanting, "Sudan is our country and we are all brothers," to the large crowd gathered in the South Sudanese capital, Juba. He described the event with optimism. Burhan says that it is a great day for the destiny of Sudan's people, since the nation achieved the goal of a revolution, which is peace, after many years of war, putting a stop to bloodshed and giving the people a decent standard of living. Sudan's interim prime minister, Abdallah Hamdok, thanked all factions and leaders that joined the peace accord, ending his country's bloody 17-year conflict, and he urged the two remaining factions, which have not signed the peace deal, to come on board. He says that there can be no development without peace and no peace without fair and equitable development, all of which contribute to democracy. He adds that the country is waiting for the two rebel leaders who have not signed the accord, Abdelaziz Helu and Abdelwahad Nour, to join it. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir, who oversaw months of difficult negotiations which led up to the August accord, told the crowd that he was delighted by the agreement and proud of the accomplishment, since South Sudan itself is still recovering from a long conflict. Kiir also thanked the international community for its support and encouragement in brokering the deal, insisting that our work is not done and we will not relax until our aspirations for a peaceful region are achieved. He warned the outside world that Sudan needs its help and aid. The leader of one of the factions which signed the joint peace deal, Arko Minawi, stressed that it was a step in the right direction. He says that sharing power during this interim period in Sudan will guarantee the rights of all and lead to a secure and lasting democracy in the future. The Sudanese peace accord includes eight protocols and will restructure the country into eight regions, replacing the country's current 18 provinces. The deal also includes a wealth-sharing provision, reparations for those hurt by the long conflict, and promises the return of refugees displaced by fighting. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Dante, AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. The Philippines has less than 1% of reported COVID-19 cases with 319,000 with about 319,000 currently, according to data from the Johns Hopkins University. Social distancing guidelines, however, remain in effect in the country. VOA's Arash Arbasadi reports on a religious celebration there that went mobile amid the pandemic.
Sunday in Manila, drivers lined up to take part in the annual observance of World Animal Day. A Catholic priest wearing a mask blessed pets in the capital city as the animals and their owners stayed in their vehicles.
It's very important for us then to have our pet blessed because we feel like our pet talaga is really part of our family. And of course, we really want the best for his health too. And that's why we decided to join the pet blessing for today.
The priest sprinkled holy water on pets in this drive-through religious ceremony. It was all part of a celebration dating back almost a century with a stated goal to improve animal welfare around the world. Fears of coronavirus contagion, however, changed the ceremony's blueprint. Event organizer, Richie Pascual.
But this time around, as mentioned, we have to adapt to the new normal. And the pandemic should never stop us from paying tribute to the furry animals that we have.
Animal activist Heinrich Zimmermann organized the first World Animal Day held in Berlin in 1925. In 1929, the official date changed to October 4th, a day Catholics celebrate the feast of St. Francis of Assisi, the patron saint of animals. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News, Washington.
It's been 4 years since Rihanna released an album, but the singer is working hard on recording new music now. The 32-year-old pop star has a new album coming out that she says she's already held tons of writing camps on, where songwriters are put into groups to create original tracks for artists. She says she's asked herself how she feels, what she wants to put out, and how she wants her art to play out. Her only 2020 release has been Believe It with Party Next Door. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. You can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you for being with us.
Hello. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.